The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. It's August. Football fans are gearing up for the next season in college football and high school football, NFL football. Ohio's a football mecca. Did you know that 100 years ago, there were NFL teams in little towns in Ohio? You think about the NFL in Ohio, you think about Cleveland, you think about Cincinnati. Do you think about places like Portsmouth? Well, there was a team there. We're going to bring you an interview today with Carl Becker, longtime professor at Wright State, who published a book back in 1998 called Home and Away, The Rise and Fall of Professional Football on the Banks of the Ohio, 1919 to 1934. It's the best of the Book Nook.
This is quite a book. How did you get the idea?
Well, of course, I've long been interested in football, played a little when I was in high school. And I knew that a fellow from West Milton named Carl Broomball had played for the Chicago Bears in beginning in 1930. And so I decided to do an article on him, and I learned that he had played for the Portsmouth Spartans in 1929. And so I ended up doing some research on the Spartans and some other teams in that area. That's how I began to do work on these teams in Ironton, Ohio, Portsmouth, Ohio, and Ashland, Kentucky. That's how I got started on it.
Now, Carl, you look at a lot of teams from the era, but these are the three main ones.
Right.
And from reading the book, it struck me that the team in Ironton was the one that really flourished first, but by the end of the story, the end of the period, it was the Portsmouth team that was really doing exceptionally well.
Yeah, that's right. A number of teams had played in Portsmouth beginning in 1919, for example, the so-called Smokehouse, the Presidents, the Shoesteels, but the Spartans began playing in 1928, and in 1930 joined the National Football League and did very well in the league. But of course, the franchise was sold to the Detroit Lions in 1934. But yes, the Spartans did very well, nearly won the championship in 1932. But the Tanks were an excellent team. In fact, beat the Spartans in 1930 on one occasion.
Now, we think of professional football and the great majority of teams are in major cities, but then we have that anomaly, that throwback in Green Bay, Wisconsin, which really is a remnant of these early days, isn't it?
That's right. Portsmouth was only slightly larger than Green Bay when it joined the league, but there were other small cities, for example, Pottstown, Pennsylvania. There was also a team from near Marion, Ohio in 1922 and 1923. So the teams came into the league rapidly and went out rapidly, too, and many were small teams, small-town teams.
Now, I think a lot of our listeners probably don't have any idea what football was like in those days. It's my understanding that a lot of these early pro and semi-pro teams had college players who were still in college, and a lot of them were playing under assumed names, and the rules were really different. Give us a thumbnail sketch of what it was like.
Well, probably there's some exaggeration on the use of these collegiate players who played under assumed names. They were usually called ringers, by the way. Of course, they appeared in baseball, too. There was a celebrated incident in Ironton in 1921 when three collegiate players played under assumed names, and the team, the Ironton Tanks, beat the Portsmouth team that year, and the Portsmouth team refused to pay them because of the use of the ringers. The use of ringers, I think, was gradually disappearing by 1923, 24, thereabouts. The game, of course, was quite different from what we know today. Men played both ways, defense, offense, and usually the roster numbered 17, 18 men. That was about it. The equipment, of course, was much less sophisticated than we know now. The helmet, for example, was of leather. There was no cradle. I was just reading the other day about the cleats that were introduced in 1921. The metal cleats were attached to a post coming out of the shoe. Can you imagine what might happen if a cleat should come off? Men would be having that post would be available as a spike, as it were. So it was rough play, certainly. Rules made it difficult for what one might call a wide open game. For example, in passing, the pass had to come from at least 5 yards from behind the line of scrimmage. If a pass went out of bounds at one point, at one time in the rules, a team lost the ball, and the rules really inhibited what one might call a wide open game. The teams usually ran from what we would call a single wing. The T was known, but was not very often used. The Chicago Bears used it through the 1920s, but not very effectively. The crowds typically in southern Ohio ran 2,500, 3,000, 4,000. I might note, Vic, that the Dayton Triangles were playing at the time in the NFL. And played the Portsmouth Spartans on one or two occasions.
So wow.
The Triangles, by the way, a kind of sainted memory in Dayton, although the team was not very good. In its last 5 years in the league, won only one or two games.
Well, people have long memories, and they get fonder as the years go by.
Yeah, they tend to exaggerate how good these teams were.
My guest is Carl Becker, and his book is Home and Away, The Rise and Fall of Professional Football on the Banks of the Ohio, 1919 to 1934. Carl, you had a very long bit of research to do. I take it you went through a lot of old newspapers and a lot of things like that, and you're very fortunate to have an All-American halfback who is still living from those days with the Portsmouth Spartans as a resource. Tell us a little bit about Glenn.
Sure, Vic. His name is Glenn Presnell. Glenn graduated from the University of Nebraska in 1928. In that year, the manager of the Tanks decided that he would go out and recruit some good collegians, and the business community was behind him, had some money ready to help him. So he wrote letters to a number of colleges and came up with three young men who visited Ironton in the spring of 1928, and among them was Glenn Presnell. And Glenn signed with the Tanks in 1928, became its coach, also got a teaching job in Lawrence County, and played for the Tanks in 28, 29, 30. And then from 31 through 33, he played for the Spartans, and then went on to play for the Detroit Lions, led them to a championship in 1935. Glenn is still living. He's living near Iron. I must say he is one of nature's noblemen. He truly is. He's about 92, 93, was playing golf until just a year or so ago. He was athletic director at Eastern Kentucky at one time, too, was football coach there. He tells me that he gets calls almost every week from people who were interested in his career and what was happening in pro football in the 1920s. Incidentally, I dedicated the book to Glenn. He really is a marvelous man. He should be in the Hall of Fame, Pro Football Hall of Fame, but he isn't.
Well, you know, the last sports interview I had on this program was with a guy named Sparky Anderson,
yeah,
and he says the same thing about Pete Rose.
Yeah, well, I don't, the complaint here or the explanation is that Glenn didn't play many years in the NFL, only about 6 years. A couple of his best years were with the Iron Tanks, but there is some agitation down there to do something about getting him in the Pro Football Hall of Fame as an old-timer. I don't know whether it'll come to anything or not. It'll be interesting to see, but I would certainly support it. He was a fine athlete. He, for years, he held the league record for the length of a field goal. I think it was 54 yards. That was held until only several years ago.
Well, it's a darn shame, Carl, that a lot of times folks aren't honored in their lifetimes.
Well, he certainly deserves it.
My guest is Carl Becker, and we're talking about his book, Home and Away. And back in 1932, there was a playoff game between the Spartans and the Chicago Bears in Chicago Stadium that resulted in a major rules change. Describe what happened.
Okay, Vic. Very interesting. What happened was that the Spartans tied with the Bears for the league championship. Incidentally, the Bears had six ties that year. I think the Spartans had four. Ties did not count in the standings, didn't count in any way. So they played the playoff game in Chicago at the Chicago Stadium. The week before, there had been heavy snow, freezing rain at Wrigley Field, so they decided to play at the Chicago Stadium. And they had to adopt new rules because the stadium permitted a field of only about 80 yards in length, you see. So the game was played there. I should note a circus had been there the week before, and some of the droppings from the circus animals still could be, if not seen, the odor was still there. In any case, the game was very hard fought. It was tied until the last few minutes of the fourth quarter. And at that point, Chicago intercepted a pass thrown by one of the Tanks players. And the Bears got down to, I think it was a two-yard line, fourth down. The quarterback, Broomball, a fellow from West Milton, handed the ball off to Red Grange, who plunged ahead towards the line, then stopped, retreated a step or so, and threw the ball into the end zone to Red Grange for a touchdown that won the game for the Bears. Immediately, coach of the Spartans, a fellow named Potsy Clark, ran onto the field complaining, saying that Nagurski was not 5 yards behind the line of scrimmage. And apparently he really wasn't. I talked to a fellow named Ox Emerson several years ago, who was a tackle for the Spartans. Emerson still was complaining that he had Nagurski by his legs at the line of scrimmage when he threw the ball, but the referees wouldn't hear the protest, allowed the touchdown to stand. And at the next owners' meeting, the owners decided to change that rule. That is, they said that the pass could be thrown from anywhere behind the line of scrimmage. And that really helped open the game. It revolutionized the passing game. George Halas of the Bears thought it was the most important rule change of the 1930s, and I think it really was. But they're still lamenting that fact down at Portsmouth that they lost the game on a disputed play. They have long memories there.
Bronco Nagurski, Red Grange, Jim Thorpe, these names really conjure up some images of the past. A lot of these players played both ways, and they were tough guys. They weren't as big as the players now.
No, not nearly as big. Vic, I might mention that Jim Thorpe came to Portsmouth in 1927 to coach a team called the Shoe Steels. It was sponsored by owners of shoe factories and steel mills down there. The team is called the Shoe Steels. Thorpe played a little, but not very well. He was over the hill, but he refused to coach the last game of the season, saying that his contract called for him to coach only 10 games. He said if they could find a kennel for his dog, he might stay on for an 11th game, but that didn't happen, and he left town.
Now, a newspaper said that in one of those games, that he was hitting the line so hard that five guys were carried off the field.
Yeah, so the newspaper men said. Sometimes one wonders about the accuracy of their stories. They tended to be cheerleaders, you know.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, that was a typical kind of story one heard about Jim Thorpe and of other players, too.
Now, the Spartans from Portsmouth, they were also a major spoiler for Green Bay's attempt to have four straight NFL championships. Tell us that story.
Well, I want to try to remember all the details of this. It was 32. The Packers came down to Portsmouth to play. Earlier in the season, the Packers had won in a game. It was there was some kind of dispute. I forget what it was about. In any case, Patsy Clark vowed that he would beat the Packers with only 11 men, 11 Iron Men. And, well, they proceeded to beat the Packers rather handily, I think 19-0. Huge crowd there, well over 15,000, which for a town of around 33,000 was a very large crowd. Well, I guess the population was a little closer to 40,000. But after the game, the Green Bay Packers complained that women had taunted them. They were throwing eggs at them. The owner of the Green Bay Packers said he had never seen anything like it in his life. He was very, he said he was appalled by the lack of sportsmanship. But that was really an intense game and long remembered again in Portsmouth.
Now, reading the book, it struck me that the Ironton Tanks had quite a bit of community support, as did the Portsmouth Spartans. It seemed to me, however, that the Ashland Armcos didn't really have the community support of the other two teams.
Well, I think that's true. I try to argue that throughout the book, Vic. The Armcos were sponsored by the Employees Association of the Armco Company that had a large mill in Ashland. Armco had put up the mill in about 1921 or 1922, and in 1925, the Employees Association kind of they sponsored all kinds of social and recreational events, sponsored the Ashland Armcos. And the Armcos were really a very good team. After the first year, they had winning seasons every year. In fact, in 1929, the NFL was putting out feelers for the Armcos to join the NFL. But it seems to me that the team never became really a town team, eliciting support from the whole community. It was viewed as a kind of an adjunct of the Armco company. Now, attendance was fairly large at the games, but the allegation was that foremen coerced workers to buy season tickets, and there seems to be some truth in that. So, one never sees any large-scale campaign to raise money to support the team in the community as one found in Portsmouth or in Ironton. That's it. When the Armco Association decided to abandon the team, there was no cry throughout Ashland to do something about it, as was the case in both Portsmouth and especially in Ironton. So I think to illustrate what I mean, when I went down to Ashland a couple of weeks ago to do a little book signing, very few people appeared. I think the Armcos never made much of an impression on the people in Ashland. And moreover, I think that they were more interested in the high school team, which was very good in those years. That's some of my explanation for that lack of interest or support.
You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. Carl Becker is my guest, and he's the author of a new book called Home and Away, The Rise and the Fall of Professional Football on the Banks of the Ohio, 1919-1934. 1934, of course, were at the height of the Great Depression. What ended? What caused the fall of professional football in Ohio?
Well, I think you hit it, Vic. It was money. The economy simply wouldn't support the team in Portsmouth, Ohio. As one of the players pointed out, they had larger crowds at the practices sometimes than at the games. He went ahead to say that there simply wasn't enough money to support the team. The team had to compete with other larger cities for players, and Portsmouth found it increasingly difficult to do that, and simply could not meet its payroll, and both in 32 and 33 experienced problems. fact, in 32, even though they were playing very well, the Spartans threatened not to play one game because they had not received their weekly pay. In 1933, often the franchise was paying them in stock in the company. Of course, the stock was worthless.
Uh-huh.
So it pretty much an economic explanation. And as you well know, there's only really one small town left in the NFL. The smaller community simply could not support football at a professional level.
And Green Bay, Wisconsin, is an anomaly because of the way that they've divided the ownership of the team.
Right, right. Virtually, as I understand it, it's public ownership. But a number of other communities had tried to keep teams in the league, but couldn't do it. Pottstown, for example. The Rock Island Independents. Even Canton and Massillon had very good teams in the league in the early 1920s, but couldn't continue to support them.
Carl, I know you've written some other things, and I'm particularly fascinated by the work you did with the letters from a Civil War soldier in Yellow Springs, Ohio. Tell us a little bit about that project.
These letters were called the Ladley letters, Vic. They are letters written by Oscar Ladley, who was a captain in the 75th Ohio Volunteer Infantry. Letters to his mother and his sister. They lived in Yellow Springs. The collection is unusual in this respect. Ordinarily, all you see are letters from the soldier to his home, to his family. But in this case, for the first 2 years, we had the letters from his sisters to him. That makes it somewhat different from most Civil War collections. He fought at Gettysburg, at Chancellorsville. Then when he was discharged, went into the jewelry business. I think it was in Philadelphia, but found that hard going and joined the regular army and went to the west into North Dakota, South Dakota territory, and stayed with the regular army till his death in about... It was in 1881. There are still some relatives of Ladley in Yellow Springs. The house where he lived is still standing on the Dayton-Yellow Springs Road.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know the address, but it is there.
Well, we probably have somebody listening on the radio in that house right now, Carl.
Yeah, probably.
Carl, your area of specialty is Civil War history, particularly Ohio politics in Civil War history. Is there a particular area of Ohio politics that you specialized in?
Well, I became interested in the so-called Copperheads, the wing of the Democratic Party that opposed the administration during the war.
Led by Vallandigham?
Led by Vallandigham in Dayton. Vallandigham was, of course, a representative to Congress. I think he was elected first in 1858, maybe 56, 58, and 60, of course, and then lost the election in 62 in a disputed election that received national attention. He was one of the sharpest critics of the Lincoln administration, which finally exiled him to the South. He was originally sentenced to spend the duration of the war in a military prison. But Lincoln, believing that he would become a martyr if that happened, exiled him to the South. The South wouldn't accept him. He ended up in Canada and ran for the governorship of Ohio in 1863 from Canada, of all things.
Wow. Well,
and it did pretty well in the vote, but lost.
Well, Ohio was really a major political force with all the electoral votes they had during this period, weren't they?
They certainly were, and of course we had quite a few generals from Ohio. We know, of course, of Grant and Sherman, but there were many, many others, of course.
Well, Carl, I really enjoyed reading your book, Home and Away, The Rise and Fall of Professional Football on the Banks of the Ohio. Are you working on any new books?
Well, I'm kind of fiddling around with a thing on the man who served in the Army, Navy, Marines from Mimesburg in World War II. I don't know whether anything will happen or not. I'm a little weary of all of this.
It sounds like you stay pretty busy.
Yeah, I do.
No such thing as retiring, right?
No. Yeah, finally, when I got out of teaching, I was able to do some of the things I really wanted to do.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, the thing I love about academic presses like Ohio University Press is that they can publish books that really focus on some specific subject areas that you're just not going to find anywhere else.
Yeah, I think that's true. There, I noticed the University of Akron has just published a book on pro football. But the I think you'll agree, Vic, that the a book published by Ohio U is handsome physically. Now, maybe the contents might put people to sleep, but the it's a truly a handsome book.
Well, I think they did a good job, and I don't think it'll put football fans to sleep.
I hope not.
Carl, we really appreciate you taking the time to stop by the Book Nook.
Okay, Vic, thanks for having me.
And that was the late Carl Becker talking about his book Home and Away, The Rise and Fall of Professional Football on the Banks of the Ohio, 1919 to 1934. Carl was quite a historian. He was on the faculty at Wright State for many years in the history department. He was the chair of the history department. He was born on May 5th, 1924 in Miamisburg, Ohio. He died October 13th, 2008 in Miamisburg, Ohio. That was his town, but he went out and got educated. In 1942, after he graduated from Miamisburg High School, he went to Otterbein College, got his undergraduate there, went on to a master's in history at the University of Wisconsin, and got his doctorate at the University of Cincinnati. He was the author, co-author, or co-editor over 100 books. Amazing. Carl Becker, his only appearance on the program, talking about the good old days of the National Football League in little towns in Ohio and Ashland, Kentucky, of all places. Amazing. Could you believe it? Did you know that we had football in Ohio back then in all those places? All these little towns, and it's an amazing history. The only one left in a smaller community is the Green Bay Packers. All the rest of them are in big cities. And just picture it. Picture those games. They weren't wearing very much equipment. I loved his stories. And it's about time for some football in Ohio. People were getting ready. Those high school teams, I'm sure they're probably out there scrimmaging already. College teams. And, of course, the NFL. For the best of the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. If you go to wyso.org, you can find over 1,200 interviews archived as podcasts. You can listen to them at your leisure. I know a woman here in Yellow Springs who says that she listens to the podcasts before she goes to sleep at night. I saw her the other day downtown. She said, "I go to bed with you every night, Vic." I thought that was very sweet. For the best of the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.